I'm going to start recording now. It'll be in the midst of this lecture. So this is lecture one. Let me do the lights. Make it not too dark. I don't want the lights on me. I want the lights on you. What if I do that? Nope. Oh well, I'll just use the natural light and hope that helps keep you awake a little bit. So now we start on the actual content that I want to test you on. My thing isn't working. I might have to stand here and do this. This was at the end of lecture zero. We didn't get time for it last time, but when I asked you the last question on the survey, I actually got different answers from what I was wanting you to give me. They weren't wrong answers. You read the question one way differently than what I had intended the question to be. What I had intended that question to be on the survey was to tell me the components of the natural Puget Sound ecosystem that go into supporting salmon, which will basically give us a tour of the system that is of our interest. So this is my diagram of what that's going to be. And I wish my little gizmo worked. I'll try it one more time. No, it just doesn't want to do it. So we're going to start in the atmosphere with weather and climate. And the next lecture we'll talk about this specifically. By the end of the course, we'll do all of these. In fact, sooner than that, in this first unit, we'll do all of these, and then we'll take in-depth looks at certain ones of them. For our purposes, we're going to follow the water that comes out of the sky, as it's doing today, that's going to land on the ground. These are some properties of the ground that are going to be of interest to us, that are going to affect the nature of the habitat and how water behaves when it's on the ground. Right, so the topography, meaning how high, how low, how steep, how rugged, etc. The type of soil is going to contribute to what happens to the water when it hits the ground. Likewise, the land cover. Land cover can be either natural land cover, like trees or bushes or grass or something like that, or it can be artificial land cover, such as where you're sitting right now. The type of land cover, as well as what's under the ground in the soil, has a big effect on what happens to the water. And actually, these little arrows going backwards are things you might not be aware of. We're not going to spend a lot of time on them, but I want to make a note of it. What's on the ground can actually affect the weather, meaning if you take a forested area, strip off all the trees, that will actually affect the weather above that particular area. Water, instead of soaking into the ground, may evaporate more readily. You may get more rainfall in that spot than you would if there were trees there or something like that. That's going to be of less interest to us than, say, people in the Amazon rainforest, where they're actually seeing the regional climate appear to change because of the drastic reduction in the coverage of trees down there. All right, well, once the water is on the ground, it goes into streams and then into rivers. Those streams and rivers in turn can affect the land. If you have big floods, that can deposit sediment and make you a floodplain. If you have a steep hill, that water can run off and erode the hillside, etc. We're going to spend a fair amount of time looking at our Ocean 260, Environment 260 level at conditions in streams and rivers, and particularly their biological effects. So then the water flows to the streams and goes out into Puget Sound, and from there out into the Pacific Ocean. I didn't have an arrow going backwards from the sound and the ocean to the streams and rivers. I could hook up a reason for one, but I didn't put one in there. Really, the effect is when it completes the cycle, water evaporates back out of the sound and the ocean into the atmosphere, and this water then in the ocean and the sound affects the land again by affecting the weather. All right. Now, well, there's some pieces missing from this. Here's your basic hydrologic cycle, which I asked you about in the survey. We're going to now put biology into that with the salmon. Now, let's see. What affects the salmon? Well, directly at the juvenile and larval and egg stages, the earliest stages of the life history, which I'll be going into, I guess it'll be Tuesday, they're affected by the conditions in the rivers they live in. When they go out to sea as adults, they're in, as late stage juveniles, as we'll see, they're affected by conditions out there. Are they affected by anything else? Well, they're affected by the last part of the system that we're going to look at in the course of humans. And there's going to be an arrow from the humans to each of these boxes. Certainly we affect affect everything in this green box. We bulldoze, we till, we cut down trees, we plant something else, we build buildings, we build roads. Drastic impact on the land and its cover. We alter streams and rivers, both directly and indirectly. If we alter these things, then that's going to alter that. But also, sometimes we take water and we put it behind dams, or we take it out of the river and we put it on our crops, or we drink it, or whatever. Run it through turbines, all sorts of things. Do we affect the sound and ocean conditions? Well, that's a little harder to do, but certainly if we, say, put toxins into the water or something like that, that can have a big effect. If we put sewage in, that's one of the things we're going to take a closer look at. And now some people are arguing that we're affecting weather and climate. More climate than weather, and we'll talk about the difference between those two later on. Some people think we're not affecting it. I would say the number of people who think we are is growing, and the number of people who think we are not is shrinking. And of course we can affect the salmon directly by putting a little butter and a little lemon on, maybe a little dill weed, you know, and putting it on a plate. And we have other ways of affecting them directly, but that's the one I think of immediately. All right, we're going to start looking at the green box part of this, and that's pretty much where we're going to be for this entire lecture, which I think is going to take all of today. Please go ahead and raise your hand if you have a question at any point, even though I'm going to get up ahead of steam and look like I'm moving pretty fast if you get confused at any point or think of something that I'm not thinking of, go ahead and put your hand up. There, as I said, there will be an audience participation component, a brief one, but I hope one that'll wake you up if you've drifted off. Okay, so there is the picture. This is from the Shared Salmon Strategy document, which was one of the readings for this section, just a short introductory section. This is an artist's depiction of the Puget Sound watershed from space, and the colored in areas are all the areas that drain to Puget Sound, including the larger area of Puget Sound, which I'll go through piece by piece here in a minute. So here's the crest of the Olympics here, the crest of the Cascades here. We're not including anything that's outside the United States in the colored in area, although you could argue that certainly geologically, hydrologically speaking, it is. All right, I want to take a look at this land surface and its components in a bunch of different ways and use the, how many people have heard the poem, The Blind Man and the Elephant? Wow, nobody. Oh, I should have brought a copy and read it to you. It's from the 1800s sometime, I believe. But it's the story of several blind men examining an elephant. And, of course, they're examining it with their hands. They can't see the whole animal. All they can see is what they see with their hands that's right in front of them. So depending which part of the elephant they're touching, they have a very different view of it. One of them is touching a leg, said, oh, elephant's obviously very similar to a tree. And one of them is touching the tail, says, oh, obviously an elephant's very similar to a snake, etc. So everybody has a different view depending on what lenses you're viewing through, let's say. So we're going to look at the same system and classify it in many different ways. First, we're going to look at the salt water in the sound and look at the divisions of that. Then we're going to look at the water, different sub-watersheds within the total watershed on land. Then we're going to look at different land elevations. That's going to be correlated with different types of plants that grow there. Something somewhat similar, land cover and land use. Land cover, one type of land cover is vegetation, but other types of land cover, lack of vegetation or buildings and roads and so forth. And so that gets into land use, human alteration. Then we're going to look at how humans came along and drew their own hypothetical lines, and in some cases not so hypothetical if you build a fence or something like that. Governmental divisions. And finally, by where people live. All of these are going to give us different views of the sound, and it may seem like I'm spending an inordinate amount of time on these divisions, and that was what I was thinking about 11 o'clock last night. But I feel this is important because this is going to lead to understanding the interface between the natural environment and science versus the human environment and our management of the natural environment. There's all sorts of mismatches and conflicts that arise when we are trying to operate by one of these criteria, when nature is trying to operate by a different one. So if we're thinking the leg of the elephant is a tree, when say somebody else is scooping up what comes out the other end of the elephant, I didn't make a very good analogy, I guess. All right, saltwater basins, leave that one behind. First, let's look at what's outside of what we call Puget Sound. The Strait of Georgia is up there. I'm going to go through several slides here that identify these one by one. We have five major basins in the U.S. part of this inland sea. Strait of Juan de Fuca, I won't point these out because subsequent slides will. The Whidbey Basin, named after Whidbey Island. The Main Basin, which is where Seattle is located. Hood Canal over against the Olympic Peninsula and the Southern Sound. Way towards the end of the course, people in the lab will be looking at a physical model as well as a computer model, and it's important to know these distinctions. All right, so the Strait of Georgia up here in Canadian waters. Strait of Juan de Fuca is there between the peninsula and the island. Whidbey Basin is everything that's east of, inside of Whidbey Island, which is this island right here. The Main Basin, we'll zoom in, is along here between the mainland and the Kitsap Peninsula. Hood Canal is this hooked feature way over here. And finally, the Southern Sound is what's complex series of embayments down here south of Tacoma. Let's zoom in on those some more. Montefiore Strait, there's the Whidbey Basin, zoomed in. Includes channels on either side of Kameno Island, which is the smaller island inside of Whidbey Island there. All right. The Main Basin is there, relatively long and straight channel. Hood Canal, I haven't included all of it in this box, but you can see it connects up here by Whidbey Island and branches off from the rest of the sound. And finally, the Southern Sound, if you were to zoom in even more, there's a whole maze of bays and inlets and so forth down there. Why am I telling you all this? Well, even though it's the first one I do, because Puget Sound is, it leads in the name of the course, we won't really use this until much later in the course. But the way that the shape of the sound is configured affects how the water moves in the basin. That water movement, in turn, along with depth and other factors, affects production by plants and animals. affects the type of shoreline that's present, whether you have steep clay bluffs like out at Discovery Park or whether you have a nice wide sandy beach or something like that. In turn, the circulation also affects what happens if you put wastes and other pollutants into the sound. Do they get flushed out to sea? Do they get trapped in the Puget Sound? And the fact that Puget Sound, the volume of water in Puget Sound isn't just one big fishbowl. Instead, it's divided up into all these little sub-areas. When you do that, you greatly increase the miles of shoreline. We have something like 2,300 miles of shoreline in such a small area. Next, the watersheds. Here's a shared strategy diagram. It's a little hard for you to discern, so I hope you'll look at the document itself online when we get there. We already talked about what is a watershed. We looked at the Puget Sound watershed as a whole. So it's the land area. Each of these land areas has a downstream point at which all of the rain and snow that falls on here drains into salt water at that point. And of course, it's the topography that defines it. This is the Cascade Crest, so anything that falls east of there goes into eastern Washington, out the Columbia, basically. Anything that falls west of there goes into Puget Sound, but then there's sub-ridges, so that water on one side flows one way, water on the other side flows the other. Okay. We're going to name these watersheds. They're hard for you to read there, I know. There's various ways to decide where you should draw the boundary line. We're going to use the state government's designation of these. They have created what they call water resource inventory areas, abbreviated WRIA, or just can't avoid pronouncing it WIRA as though it were WIRA. It's too hard to say WIRA, so you'll hear everybody call them WIRAs. And the state numbers them. We're going to look at these in lab tomorrow, those of you people that will be there. Number one, starting at the north part of the state, is the watershed of the Nooksack River and its tributaries. And actually, they include some other small streams that flow directly into Puget Sound rather than flow into the Nooksack before entering the Sound. So they include every square inch of the state in one of these WIRAs, even if the stream doesn't flow into the river after which the WIRA is named. All right, so we're going to count these down. I'm not going to ask you to know these. I mean, I just take it back. I will want you to know these for the course, but I don't expect people to know these here today. The audience participation later on is something I would expect you to know already, and I will want you to know later on. So flowing into the Strait of Georgia, we have the Nooksack. That's the only one in Washington, the only WIRA in Washington. We have three that enter the Whidbey Basin, three drainages. The Skagit, which Skagit's the largest river entering Puget Sound. The Stillaguamish, a smaller one, and the Snohomish WIRA, or watershed. We're going to spend a lot of time on the Snohomish. Initially, I was going to make the whole course focus on the Snohomish because the most work on salmon has been done in that watershed. It turned out we had trouble finding case studies of everything we wanted to look at, so we're going to branch out mainly to the south, to the ones I'm going to show you next, and be doing basically the Snohomish and a couple of others. Entering the main basin, we have the Cedar Sammamish WIRA, or watershed, which is number 8. Snohomish is number 7, which includes Lake Washington and Lake Sammamish, the Ship Canal. If you look right out here, that's WIRA number 8. That's where the water goes. Comes down from around Issaquah into Lake Sammamish. Lake Sammamish flows into Lake Washington. Lake Washington flows out right before our eyes. The Duwamish River, which is fed upstream by the Green River, which actually originates up by Mount Rainier. The Puyallup River drains into Commencement Bay at Tacoma. And going into the South Sound, we have a small river called the Deschutes, which goes into Bud Inlet, where Olympia is. The Capitol building looks down on Bud Inlet, and the Deschutes River feeds into there. We have a big river coming off Mount Rainier, the Nisqually River. And here I'm interchangeably talking about the rivers and the watersheds. in this case. As I said, there's some small streams in each of these Wairas in addition to the major rivers. Small streams that go directly into the Sound. All right. There's a bunch of places where we have no major rivers, but we have small streams, for example, in the San Juan Islands. So this one isn't animating for me, is it? San Juan Islands, Whidbey Island, the Kitsap Peninsula, and some of the inlets of the Southern Sound. This is what the Kennedy-Goldsboro Waira. This is the Hood Canal Waira. We'll look at that in a minute. We also have a couple of fairly significant rivers, the Dungeness and the Elwha. And if you even go further, you get into coastal rivers. These two feed into the Strait of Juan de Fuca. I'm being complete here. We're going to emphasize, as I said, 7, 8, and 9, especially 7, the Snohomish. Also 8, the Cedar, Sammamish, Lake Washington. And number 9 is the Duwamish Green. Hood Canal, we're going to look at towards the end of the course. There's several rivers that flow into here. The Quilcene River. Don't expect a test asking you to memorize these. Instead, expect something that will ask you to use this information to think about some issues that will be coming up. Duckenbush, those wallops, and the Skokomish. The Skokomish River is in the news quite frequently. Usually when we get a rainfall event, kind of like today's or the ones we've been having in the last month or so, Skokomish is the first one to flood. It's got a lot of human alterations to it that cause it to flood easily. We may or may not spend much time looking at that, but we will be looking at the things that cause rivers to flood. All right, and there are small creeks entering in there too. All right, so why do we go through all of this work to examine the watersheds? Well, biologically, very important. Salmon migrate into each of these river systems, and the genetics are slightly different in each one. There's what we call salmon stocks. And that can be a very elastic definition, but essentially we're considering genetic differences between fish river by river. So that has very important value for managing salmon. All right, and of course, each of these is totally independent of the other in terms of water supply, both when it comes to flooding or if it comes to using the water, drawing the water out of the river for irrigation or drinking water or whatever. You can do whatever you want to in one watershed. It's probably not going to affect the next one up. All right, and so if you do something to the land that alters the hydrologic functioning of the land, it's going to affect the other land in that watershed. Not necessarily, in fact, assumedly not going to affect the land over in the next watershed. So these are units of hydrologic functioning. All right? And of course, it makes it hard to transport water from one watershed to another. If you want to do that, you have to undertake considerable effort. Landforms, okay. I'm going to show you this PRISM program, one of the components. It's not a research component, instead it's a service component, is a visualization lab. A lot of what we're going to do in the lab is generated both by the mapping people up in Earth and Space Sciences, and some of it will be generated by the people in the visualization lab, which is actually in this building. So I'm going to show you some examples of what they do visually, and then there's also content in this. They visualize some of the research databases and research results that are produced by the researchers. So behind what the visualizations I'm going to show you here in a second are these scientific databases that give them the information. All right, so these are pretty spiffy graphics. I couldn't make these myself. and these are using these quality visualizations to show you several things that we're going to be studying. For example, in one of the labs, we're going to work on a model that goes by this acronym. I won't trouble you with it right now. But here you can see the terrain visualized in pseudo three dimensions. And then here it is in perspective view. And these are what we call data layers. The lab people are going to be working with data layers. They can superimpose values for these different properties on top of the terrain to give you kind of what it would look like from space if you were an alien up there in a flying saucer and you had special goggles that would let you tell what kind of soil, for example, or what kind of land cover was on there. We'll look at these one by one. All right. So there's just the terrain highlighted by color. Very pretty to look at. People that really like maps are going to like these parts. People that aren't so interested in maps, well, go along for the ride. This layer is watersheds. Okay, we've looked at this before. Here's the upper Snohomish watershed. Here's the Stillaguamish watershed. This is Lake Washington and so forth. Here is land cover. We're going to take a closer look at this in just a minute. And we're going to look at it in the lab, too. This color coding lets you know the types of land cover, and having it superimposed on the elevation is going to let us see the correspondence between elevation and the type of land cover. This one is just to show you pretty pictures of what we're going to talk about coming up. And likewise, there's the soils. Again, you can see there's a correspondence. We're not going to talk in this section about soils. I'm not even sure we're going to talk about it until for a couple of weeks yet in the lab, but you can see there's some correspondence between the type of soil and the elevation, which isn't shouldn't be surprising. All right, let's look at what we want to know out of this. Still, though, I'm going to show you things for illustration. I'm going to show you the type of things we're going to be studying in more detail when we look at individual cases. And the lab people will actually play with these interactively rather than just watching them in the PowerPoint. And they'll need to look in a bit more detail at what I'm going to show you. All right, why do we care about elevation? I've said something about this already. And when we talk about weather and hydrology, you actually get different amounts of rain and snow at different elevations. That shouldn't surprise you if you lived here very long. You get different temperatures, and so different growing seasons at different elevations. You get different soils, as I showed you in the picture just a moment ago. And therefore, all of these things go together to affect how the rivers flow. The model that we're going to look at in the lab that simulates how streams respond to weather incorporates all of these things and more. Steeper ground, rockier ground, type of soil, type of vegetation, all goes into how rainfall and snowfall translate into stream flow. All of these things also affect the type of vegetation, which in turn affects the flow of water. And likewise, all of these things affect what kind of animals can live there, including, you know, lions and tigers and bears, oh my, but also the fish in the rivers. Here's a nice elevation map. You'll see various versions of this, various pieces of it as we go along. You can see faintly outlined in dotted red the Snohomish River watershed, which is what this is depicting. And down here is Lake Washington and so forth. Some of these may be a little slow on the uptake, and I'm throwing a lot of you of them here at you at the beginning. And again, this is, don't get panicked about the amount of detail I'm throwing at you right now. I'm mainly giving you a tour of the things that we're going to need to know later. Especially, there we go. Okay, I'm going to spend some detail looking at landforms and land cover. I've zoomed in on the legend to this, and I'm going to zoom in on particular locations. Again, I'm not asking you now to memorize that there's this kind of ground here or that kind of ground there. I'm going to show you kinds of ground that we're interested in, the kinds of places they occur, and then we're going to look at them in more detail later in this unit and beyond. So this picture shows you both the Snohomish and the Stillaguamish. There's a boundary right about in here that's not showing up. Here's the Snohomish watershed. Here's the Stillaguamish up here. And this shows you the digital elevation model, DEM. That's what you've been looking at before, the terrain. And it shows you the land cover, most of which is a type of vegetation superimposed on that. First, we'll take a look at the alpine zone. And rock and ice, the top category here, is found not very many places, as you look at this, there's a white area right up here. That's the top of a mountain called Glacier Peak. Most of this area is covered with something other than rock and ice. Right? So we'll move down in elevation. Next step now, I'm going to click through these fairly quickly. Subalpine forest. If you've ever gone up, say, to Paradise at Mount Rainier or someplace like that, or driven over the pass, well, the passes are too low for this. This is getting right up to tree line where the trees are small and there's certain types of trees that live at that elevation. You can see is these two lighter colors of green up here high. Then you get mid and low elevation forest, the darker shades of green. That's more what you get down as you're driving up towards Snoqualmie Pass or something like that, driving up to Stevens Pass. The big tall conifer trees like Doug firs and hemlocks and so forth. You can see where those are. Corresponds to the terrain pretty well. All right, moving down even further, let's see. Mixed forest and deciduous forest down in the lowlands, down along river valleys and so forth. Maples and alders and stuff like that. And floodplain, oops. Doesn't want to back up bullet by bullet, does it? Okay. Here in yellow. Back, let's say, about 200 years ago, before European settlers arrived, actually, there were areas that were kept clear of forest by even the native tribes, but basically everything you'd see here would have been covered by some sort of forest. These yellow areas here, called crop or mixed farming or irrigated crops, not much irrigation here on the wet side, these are basically the river valleys which have been cleared of forest and are now used for farming or dairy cattle grazing, that sort of thing. Again, closely corresponding to elevation. Finally, moving closer to the sound at the lowest elevations, most urbanized areas are not shown here. They're not really considered that much part of the watershed because the water that falls on us mostly goes into pipes, sewer pipes, rather than into rivers and streams naturally, with certain exceptions. All right, so urbanized areas are in pink and red, and we're just getting into the edges of them here. Non-forested areas, areas that have been logged, you can see there's major areas of clear cutting up there in the middle elevations of the mountains. Not really worth cutting the subalpine trees. They're not big enough and not valuable enough to make it worth the while. Here is another visualization, again, just to give you a broader overview and include the cities now. You can see the red area where the land cover is no longer even natural vegetation nor unnatural vegetation. It's pretty much artificial. So this is another whole way of viewing our Puget Sound Basin. Why do we care? I've been through this. Okay, the last bullet here, though, I haven't said anything about. I said that all these properties affect the flow of water, they affect the plants and animals and so forth, and different elevations and different land covers respond differently when humans perturb them, humans alter them. All right, moving down to the coastal zone, we have what we call estuaries. An estuary is where the river meets the ocean or the salt water, the river mouth. We'll do this about three-fifths of the way through the course. We have vegetation up here in what's called the supratidal zone. That is a zone that's the tides never actually cover, but which may be wet because of the infiltration of the water into the soil. So commonly in certain locations, wetlands will be adjacent to the salt water, salt marsh, for example. In the intertidal zone, we may have several kinds of conditions, and I'm just going to show you one of those, the mud flat. they're actually particularly important types of environments. That's the type of coastal environment we're going to be looking most closely at when we get there in this course. You may also have areas of sand flat. In particular, this vegetation called eelgrass, you can see the word right here, eelgrass beds, extremely valuable, not well known except to biologists. People know about seaweed much more than they know about eelgrass. Moving off into deeper water, the intertidal zone is the zone that's covered and uncovered twice a day by the tides. The subtidal zone is the shallow water that is never uncovered by the tides, has its own habitat. You've probably seen much more of shorelines that have sand, where you lay your towel out when you sun yourself or go swimming, or lots of Puget Sound beaches have various types of rough gravel on them. If you go up to the San Juan Islands, you may even see just solid rock shores or out to the coast. Why do we care? I could go on forever about this, and I'll try and keep moving here. As on land, the type of material in the ground, the type of vegetation that grow, create the habitat for animals that we value, whether for, as wildlife or as resources. And the sand and mud flats that I just showed you pictures of are particularly valuable habitats for animal habitat, for animals. They also will produce shellfish, either naturally or commercially or recreationally. The main value for the animals that we value is as nursery habitat. They spend early parts of their life history there, including salmon, but also including many other kinds of fish and shellfish. That's what we'll be looking most closely at. And again, these different types of beaches and their vegetation and animal populations have a different response to human perturbation. I'm going to show you some examples of human alteration here just in a moment. Those are some words describing the kinds of things we've done to these shore lines. I'll show you pictures in a moment. If you go up to the mouth of the Skagit, where they grow the tulips now, and they have the tulip festival every spring, it's been completely altered, even though it looks very natural. It used to be a huge mud flat. It was diked. You can still see the dikes there lining the riverbanks today. The channel was dredged out. The dredge material was piled onto the land to fill it to make what's now the croplands. We also can liberate our pollutants in there, and that contaminates these. Here's a picture from the Seattle Times, an artist's conception of an aerial view of what downtown Seattle looked like at the time the Denny Party landed to be the first European settlers in this vicinity. Elliott Bay is right here, our bay in downtown Seattle. Here's West Seattle now. The Duwamish River comes in down here. Vast, extensive mud flats with little areas of villages. And we'll spend time talking about fish like herring. Herring need to spawn on intertidal vegetation, which grows on mud flats. If you destroy that habitat, you basically limit the capacity of the system to produce herring. This is the Seattle Times version of how this looks today. All of those mud flats filled in and create the industrial Port of Seattle facilities we see there today. Up here, here's Magnolia up here. This is Pier 91. Here's where Seattle Center would be, etc. I'll show you some pictures. Here's a picture of a virgin eelgrass meadow. This is up by the mouth of the Skagit. There's Elliott Bay today, looking at the area where those two pictures from the Seattle Times were drawn. Harbor Island, etc. Not really any mud flat there today, although our field trip in the lab section will go to one of the small areas of remaining mud flat that they're trying to restore, and we get to help them do that. Here's a Google Earth aerial photo of Everett Harbor. You can still see the various braided channels of the Snohomish River coming in there. You can still see some natural-like looking mud flat habitat. You can also see in the picture the human development superimposed on that. That has not been altered as much as the mouth of the Duwamish. Obviously, there's no big industrial cranes and so forth here sitting right square in the river mouth. All right. going to run down and look at the names of the estuaries. I don't know how well you can see this type here, but it's going to match up pretty well to the names of the watersheds we looked at earlier. The Nooksack. Oops. I thought I put arrows here. I guess I didn't. The Nooksack River, the Skagit River. There's a small river called the Samish that comes in north of the Skagit. All right, there's the Stillaguamish, mouth of the Stillaguamish coming in right behind. That's Camino Island there, the Whidbey Basin. You can see the Snohomish River coming in right here at Everett. And the Cedar Green, which is not labeled here, but there's the ship canal, there's us. Cedar Green, oh, I take that back. This is the Cedar Lake Washington, Cedar Sammamish, and then the Green Duwamish follows that. So I should rewrite that. Oh, there's an arrow. Cool. Where'd all the other arrows go? Here's our friend the Duwamish again, moving down to those entering the South Sound. There's the estuary of the Puyallup River, which is also highly industrialized, the Port of Tacoma. Nisqually River actually has a wildlife refuge at its estuary. It was altered for farming, much like the Skagit, but certainly not as altered as an industrial facility. Okay, and then in Hood Canal, we saw those before. The only one I'm showing you here is the Skokomish major estuary. That's the biggest river entering Hood Canal, but each of those other rivers we saw has one too. There they are. Okay, I won't go through those again. But I will wonder why the slide isn't changing. Oh, I know why the slide isn't changing, because it wants me to give you a 5-minute break. Ready to stand up and stretch? All right, let's see if this works now. All right, this is a familiar slide. I'm going to do something a little less familiar here in just a second. Political boundaries that we impose on the natural system I've just shown you. So we've got an international border that crosses up between the Strait of Georgia and the Skagit watershed. We'll look at this in a sec. We have the state border. All of Puget Sound, other than parts that go over into Canada, are within the state of Washington. So it's not like the Columbia River, where we're having to work with Oregon as co-owners or anything like that. But we do have another group of entities, the Indian tribes, which by treaty have a certain degree of sovereignty and certain rights that make them actually in some ways superior to or equal to the state. Right? These we'll look at in next lecture or two. And we have county boundaries. And the major thing we're going to look at is how whoever laid out the counties obviously wasn't the hydrologist. So are you ready? Oh, and city boundaries, of course, too. Oh, is it going to happen? No, it didn't happen. Well, it was supposed to play a jingle. It worked when I did it in my office. Nah, too bad. I won't bother. I'm going to run short of time anyway. So this is the quiz show. Name that county. I want the audience to help me name that county. Starting with, what's up there? Hand. Yes? British Columbia. Good. It's not really a county, is it? No, it's a province. This was the trick question. I get it out of the way at the beginning. Okay? Actually, I gave it a different name. I called it Canada. But you're right. It's British Columbia. Before I go any farther, how many people here think they can name all of these counties? Okay. And this is sort of trivial stuff, but I'm going to be throwing around names of watersheds, names of counties. I'm not going to like give you necessarily a memory test and make you memorize them all. I'm not big on memorizing, but I want to be able to use these terms and have them mean something to you. Plus, it's get to know your ecosystem, and this is the political aspect of it. So, I can just ask for hands, I guess. Or let's see. I'd like to start with the three people who are here for the first time today. Or you are one of them, right? Okay, who are the other two? One, okay. Let's start all the way in the back. What's your name?
Michelle,
okay. Can you name that county? What's your name?
I'm Taylor.
Taylor, can you name that county? Okay, well, then this is of greater value to you than natives. The last person who's new today, what's your name?
Sarah.
I'm sorry.
Sarah.
Sarah.
Watcom.
Correct. Watcom County. This thing behaves differently on this machine than on my desk. All right. Moving down to the next one. Who would like to, okay, what's your name?
Melissa.
Melissa, okay. You think you can name that county?
I'm from that.
You're from that county, okay. British Columbia, right? No, tell me.
Skagit.
Skagit County, good. I wish I could carry my little thing around with me. Skagit, good. And sitting next to her is?
Melissa.
Melissa, didn't I?
Oh,
are you from that county?
No, I'm from Skagit, too.
You're from Skagit, too, but you know what your neighbor's name is. Okay. Snohomish County. Good. Well, we're getting close to home now here, so who's feeling confident about the next one?
Oh.
Ah, see, I should have waited and asked who felt confident about the next one. Over. What's your name?
Abe.
Abe, okay.
Kitsap.
Kitsap County, way to go. Possible home of the new NASCAR racetrack and lots of Navy bases and stuff like that. All right, now, toughest one of all. Who can do this one? Oh, come on, somebody's got to be up to the challenge. Okay, what's your name?
King County.
King County, but your name isn't King, right?
No, it's not.
Glenn.
Clint.
Clint, sorry. Okay. I'm going to try and remember your names. It's going to take me a while, though. Okay. Who's from this county? Anybody? Our neighbor to the south? You are looking active and awake. What's your name?
Joe.
Joe?
I was going to get
Pierce,
but I don't know.
Pierce, you got it. You pierced the veil of ignorance and got it right. All right, so those are all the counties on the east side of Puget Sound, except for one we missed, which we'll get as we go down the west side of Puget Sound. First of all, name that political entity. Somebody, yes, Clint again, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Victoria.
The city of Victoria is there. That's not wrong. You know, what am I asking for? Am I asking for the name of the nation? Am I asking for the name of the province? We've heard the name of the province already. Yes?
Vancouver Island.
That's Vancouver Island, yeah. I'm being very lenient here. I'm calling it Canada. All right. Now, these might be tougher than the other ones. What county is that? Somebody who hasn't raised their hand before. Yes, sir, what's your name?
Jason.
Jason.
San Juan.
San Juan, very good. You've seen a lot of these names already in referring to other things. Who hasn't spoken yet? This is named after an Indian tribe. Anybody want to tackle it? Yes, your name?
Amy.
There's a town called Suquamish. I'm afraid there's no county called Suquamish. Abe, right? Quinault, there's a Quinault Indian Reservation out on the coast, but there is no Quinault County. But good try. Thanks for trying. I forgot your name already.
Melissa.
Melissa. You have two Melissas side by side. Okay. I thought I had heard that name before. All right. Go ahead.
Clallam.
Way to go. This is one that, you know, you could call on the east or it's sandwiched in the middle. Somebody be brave, someone who hasn't spoken up before. Somebody's got it. You guys know, right? Okay. Let me see. California.
San
Taylor.
Is that Island County?
Island County, way to go. Whidbey Island and Camino Island. You might be tempted to call San Juan Island County because it has islands too. Question mark, that one. Thank you, Taylor. Who hasn't spoken yet? You want to try that one, Sarah? Is that too hard for you? Okay. Or was it Amy? No. The first person I asked, I forgot your name already.
Michelle,
sorry. You're from California too? Okay. Well, absorb this. Let's see, would you like a hint? It's named after a president. You guys know it. Jason.
Franklin.
We have a Franklin County in Washington, but it's in eastern Washington, I think. But thanks. Declaration of Independence. Melissa, Jefferson, good. We're almost done. There's two more. Okay. And let's see. Can I pick on you? I don't know your name yet.
Justin,
okay.
Probably
don't know it, okay. Who's in the other? I don't know your name. You were even in one of the class months, right?
Yeah. Ocean 102.
Right. What's your name?
Noah,
okay. But you, Noah, you don't know it.
Okay.
All right. Do the two Melissas know it?
Maybe.
Mason, yes, hooray. Okay, this is taking up a lot of time, but but we're almost done. Okay, can anybody name the last one without even an arrow or a question mark? There used to be a brewery down there. That doesn't help much, does it? Thurston, hooray. Who was that? And what's your name?
Julia,
okay. I didn't want these things to have to keep burping like that. Thurston, okay, that's all the counties. Phew. Now, here's a nice prismatic diagram, whoops, showing you if a hydrologist had laid out the counties, that it would have been done very differently. Each of these colors is one of the watersheds we looked at, Whatcom, Skagit. I'm sorry, this is the Skagit watershed in light blue, Whatcom County, Skagit County. You can see here's Wyra number 7, the Snohomish River watershed, includes the Snoqualmie River, which goes down into King County, and we'll be looking in more detail at that. But you can see if you want to manage a watershed, it's very difficult to do it at the county level, even though a county level would be a logical way to do it if you had drawn the county boundaries differently. All right, land ownership. We're getting close. There's two more categories, I think. Again, I'm going to show you examples and give you generalities about how they're laid out. We're going to zoom in on the Snohomish River watershed, Wyra number 7. And you can see here color coding indicating different land ownership. There's a key down here, but for our purposes, I'm just going to tell you what the colors mean. This color of green and this color of green, the sort of olive-ish here, are federally owned lands in national forests, national parks, etc. There we go. Okay. So this Mount Baker Snoqualmie National Forest, the Alpine Lakes Wilderness Area, etc. Tribal lands, the Tulalip Indian Reservation is right up here. There are other relatively small areas of tribal lands, and as I said, they're co-equal to or superior in some cases to the states in their rights, even though the amount of land they actually own is relatively limited. And they are mainly near the water because that's where their ancestral populations lived. All right, lands owned by the state. These pink areas are state forests. You may or may not know that the Department of Natural Resources of the state by law, has to have its lands logged to provide money for the schools. The state also has state parks, and it has state conservation areas, which are indicated by this rich green as opposed to the pale or the olive green. All right? The counties own some lands. And, of course, we have two counties in this watershed. The county owns some forest land. One of our first field trip will be visiting some county forest land in King County. And the counties also have park lands like Marymore Park and so forth. Those are indicated by this other color of green. So many different greens. I guess they wanted to make them all look forested if they were supposed to be trees. Notice those are getting small and widely scattered now, not like the large blocks of holdings of federal or state lands. All right, private land, private urban land. Well, if you look here in Everett, okay, lots of privately owned urban land, what you're probably most familiar with. There are patches of it out here. Here's Woodinville, here's Monroe, and so on. The towns of Carnation, Duval, etc. Privately owned farmlands. We looked at these earlier, places I said that used to be forested had been cleared and are now under agriculture. You can see those right along, and those again tend to follow the river valleys. And other privately owned lands, timber companies owned a lot of land and still do. These mottled brown areas, a lot of those are either owned by timber companies for private logging, or they're owned by descendants of timber companies that are holding them for residential development and that sort of thing. Subdivisions. All right, why do we care? This will be something of a repeat, but in each of these different jurisdictions, there's a whole different set of regulations. Got to worry about federal law, state law, county law, city law, and there's different enforcement mechanisms, depending on both who owns the land and who is in charge, meaning you may be regulated by any combination of these, depending on who owns the land and what which boundaries it's within. If you're going to manage resources that cross these boundaries, you need the participation, cooperation, coordination of all the entities that are involved. We're going to be looking at two very representative resources, water and migratory salmon, that wander all across these boundaries, across various jurisdictions, ownerships, etc. This is what's going to make the management issues so complex and so difficult. Another example of that, if you follow the salmon out into the ocean, there's an ongoing series of treaties, commissions, etc., conflicts regulating salmon out in the ocean between the U.S. and Canada, and actually between the various states too. The salmon are not paying attention to our political boundaries, especially when they get out in the ocean. You can't even draw a line at the top of a watershed or something like that and call that a natural boundary. The ocean has very subtle natural cues that the fish follow, but have nothing to do with our national boundaries. All right, so this is much of the same thing. All these various ownerships, all of these various jurisdictions, and those two are not the same thing. You may own the land, but you're under the jurisdiction of the city and or the county and the state and the federal government. And even the tribes have some rights that may affect you on your own land. Plus, corporations can own land. Nonprofit entities such as the Nature Conservancy or the Trust for Public Land can own land. So we talked Tuesday about, very briefly, about the condition of the salmon. The salmon's condition is dire, to the point of being placed under federal protection under the Endangered Species Act, which then trickles down through all these other layers. But you can see trying to get all of these ownerships and jurisdictions and so forth to work together, very difficult task. We'll be looking at that in quite a bit of detail. Okay, well, gee, I can't remember what this, oh, that's right. We're going to look at population as the last layer, but we're going to focus on, again, the Snohomish watershed to finish that up. This is where we'll be spending, as I said, most of our time. So here's just some facts about the Snohomish watershed. Breaks down into three sub-areas, roughly. The Snohomish River comes into the Sound, and it comes, it has that name only for the very last part of its length. Up here, which is on the way between Woodinville and Monroe on Highway 2, there's convergence of two other major drainages. This is the Skykomish River system. This is the Snoqualmie River system, which comes up through the towns of Fall City, Carnation, Duval, etc. If you drive over Stevens Pass, you're following the Skykomish River through Sultan, Gold Bar, Startup, Index, Skykomish, etc. There's elevation range, there's a precipitation range, just to throw some facts at you. You can see we're going from sea level up to the high mountains. We're going from, something like 3 feet a year of rain, like we get here in Seattle or Everett, up to about 9 feet a year of rain up at the top of Glacier Peak or something like that. Quite a variance in conditions. Especially in the lab, we're going to start looking also at subdivisions of this. The federal government salmon recovery technical team actually goes, there's several teams. One of them does the Snohomish Basin, divided up the Snohomish into 62 sub-basins, each having its own separate tributary to the system, again defined by the lay of the land and the way the water drains. If you look at the range of situations in these 62 sub-basins in the watershed, the forest covers as low as 7%, that would be down in the urban suburban areas, or up to 83% of the area. We're going to be looking down the road at something called impervious cover. You are sitting in impervious cover right now. Rain falls on the roof, doesn't soak into the ground, right? The ground is covered. Rain falls on the parking lot, doesn't soak into the ground, doesn't go into the river. Goes into a sewer, goes into a pipe underground, goes to the sewage treatment plant. As much as half of the area of some of these is impervious. The natural forested area is as low as zero impervious cover. All right, so here we go to the human population part, and that will take us out of here. Population's growing, in case you hadn't noticed. People are coming from California. Of course, you're just coming for college, and you might go back to California. Not to pick on you or anything, but people are having lots of babies. People are moving in. This 50% increase is predicted by government agencies between 2000 and 2020. That's a huge rate of increase, and it's going to increase the alteration of the landscape. So forests are shrinking and are likely to continue shrinking. Pavement is growing and likely to continue growing, pavement and buildings. Here's a slide. There's various ones of these. There's a slightly different version in the shared strategy document online of population density. And you can see we people tend to hug the salt water. This is from the Department, State Department of Ecology. Whoops. Oh, okay. That was it. Zooming in on our WIRA 7, Snohomish Watershed population density. Not only is it highest near the Sound, this is because, you know, we started, white people started settling here by sea, came in and settled and made seaports, and then gradually moved up the river valleys where it was more passable and settled along those, first as farms and then as towns and then as suburbs and so forth. The point here is that humans are not uniformly or randomly distributed across the habitat. They're concentrated in certain areas. Their impacts are concentrated in certain areas. Those tend to be the same areas where the salmon want to live. That's our source of conflict. Here's another series of prism slides showing you changes and projected changes in population density. Number of people per acre according to this scale down here. This is what it looked like in 1990. You can see spread across the landscape through the urban suburban area and then concentrated very highly in certain selected areas. Again, I'm not going to ask you to memorize this. This is to illustrate trends for you. The density is going to be increasing rapidly in the slides I'm going to show you. Here's how it was in 2000. This is based on, again, actual counts. There's a couple of comparison slides at the end, so we can go back and forth here. Hard to see the difference, but 2000, not so long ago, projected for, come on you, it's hanging up on me. There we go, projected for 2010. Compare these back and forth. Come on. What you see is the red getting a little redder and a little spreader, and also some new green, light green areas out here appearing where rural areas are filling in to become suburban areas. Then projected for 2020. Again, I'm waiting for it to do that. This must be a huge picture for it to load. I'm coaxing it. There we go, 2020. You can see now a lot more red splotches appeared. Again, more green filled in areas in between and spread out a little more. There are some laws about how far that green can spread towards the mountains. We'll see if those are actually still in place in 2020. Only a couple of slides left here if it will behave itself. There we go, okay. So here's a comparison of 1990 and 2020. So you can see the red area of downtown Seattle projected to get much higher and denser. More of these orange areas turn red, more of the gray areas fill in with the light green. I think there's one more, okay. This is now comparing those two. So the light blue shows not much change. The dark blue shows somewhat change. And as you get to the purple, that's where you get the most intense change. Looks to be that's going to be mostly in the urban areas, which from the point of view of preserving natural habitat is good. Planners are trying to keep people from spreading out, what they call it, sprawl, into the suburban neighborhoods, or rural areas, excuse me, and developing those. They're trying to concentrate people in the city where the impact already occurred. And that's the end of the talk, and we're out of time. So people in Section A, I'll see you tomorrow at 12:30 downstairs in room 111. Question?
Well, it's just about entry, and so you wanted to talk to